The Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. First, we will start with the roll for attendance. Anna, please proceed.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Okay, a quorum is present. First, we'll move to approval of the minutes from February 18th. Vice Chair Mueller, do I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 18th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved from February 18th, 2021. Members, today we'll be hearing three different bills. All three bills will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. We're going to get right to it because we've got a lot to cover today. First up is House File 833, Representative Herr. This is your bill. Would you like to move your bill to be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 833 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus.
All right. Thank you, Representative Herr. With that, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. The Post-Conviction Relief Bill seeks to address gaps in the Minnesota criminal justice system by allowing individuals who are wrongly convicted due to legal defects to seek justice. This bill is about expanding access to justice. Starting in the fall of 2016, ICE conducted mass raids throughout the country targeting Southeast Asian refugees from Cambodia, Vietnam, and Laos. In Minnesota, there are an estimated 250 Southeast Asians that have been put into removal proceedings. There are also Latino, African refugees, and immigrants who have been targeted as well. I've met with dozens of family members devastated by these ICE raids. The majority of the loved ones in removal proceedings who have been deported are men, sons, brothers, or fathers. These men and some women have usually served their time, paid their dues, and become lawful and productive members of society. Today, you are going to hear from several impacted family members and their stories of fear, love, and survival. You will also hear from legal experts in the areas of criminal law and immigration law and the deeply disconnected and fragmented policies we have in place that make it impossible for families to navigate the two legal systems. This bill acknowledges the flaws within our criminal justice system and the serious implications our criminal courts have on immigration law and policy. We are a nation of immigrants, and we are a nation that values family. So it's really important for us to keep families unified and communities together. Madam Chair, I know that we are, we have a lot of people here to testify today, and I want to make sure that to kind of give you the decision of I can go over the bill. It is a very simple bill. There's not a lot of language to it, but I can go over that, or we can just go into testimony and have people ask questions about the part of the bill that we are adding. What is there a preference on your part, Madam Chair?
If you have a short summary, I think that's appropriate to go ahead and explain what the bill does.
Okay. So the Minnesota criminal justice system has a sophisticated criminal code that allows for legal remedies to fix or revisit past convictions that were obtained improperly. However, our criminal law requires that individuals who are wrongly convicted must petition for relief within 2 years of the time period. This two-year time limit has created significant barriers for immigrants and refugees, and therefore, this bill seeks to establish a sixth exemption to the post-conviction relief statute. If you have the bill in front of you, I just wanted to point out that the only part that is being added is line 2.6 to 2.9, and it is just adding a sixth criteria. For context, Minnesota was one of the strictest time limits in the region to fix an improper conviction. Some states have a 10-year time limit, while others do not even have a time limit. Moreover, the time limit does not recognize the consequences of conviction may not become apparent until years or decades later. So this is especially true in the ever-shifting world of immigration. The retroactive nature of many of our federal immigration laws has now triggered consequences for people with old criminal convictions, and they are now facing deportation several years after they were convicted. This bill seeks to ensure that immigrants and refugees have access to fix a past conviction that was the result of a wrongful conviction. The bill adds an immigration-related exception to the existing list of exemptions under the two-year time limit. So with that, Madam Chair, that's just a quick overview of the bill itself. We do have a number of testifiers. The first that is going to speak is Julia Nakesa Opti from the Black Immigrant Collective.
Okay, Ms. Opti, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, and just keep in mind that we've got a lot of testifiers, so if all of our testifiers can keep that in mind and stay focused, that would be appreciated. Ms. Opti, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and Representative Gauher, thank you for supporting our bill. I'm Nakesa Opoti, and I am with the Black Immigrant Collective, which is a Minnesota-based immigrant justice organization. We are part of the Expanding Justice Coalition, where we have supported the PCR bill, as the representative has explained what it stands for. We've supported this for the last 3 years. This is a pretty large coalition of over 35 organizations, all based in Minnesota, many of them immigrant justice organizations, local governments, advocates and attorneys. And we also have the support of three Minnesota counties, Ramsey, Hennepin, and Olmsted. In fact, Ramsey County will be testifying later today. As you know, Minnesota is home to about 500,000 immigrants and refugees, many of them who are part of this group of people that are being targeted. So the Southeast Asians, African immigrants who moved here, many of them as children, and then now, years later, they are getting caught up with this immigration raids. And so it is a crisis. We are hearing a lot of painful stories from families and separation of families, including people who have started new families and are being separated from those families, as you'll hear later. And so we are also acknowledging that part of the problem and what PCS hopes to resolve is that many people who took these plea deals are often poor and cannot afford attorneys. And so sometimes they make decisions that are not in the interest of their immigration case. We also know the ways that in which in the criminal justice system has racial bias. And so a lot of people, again, not only are they poor, but they are people of color, Black and other immigrants of color. And so, you know, we really are hoping that you'll support this bill and that thank you so much for your time, and I will yield to the next person.
Thank you very much for testifying. Next on the list is Min Lam. Min, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Min, and I live in Brooklyn Park with my husband and two children. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and committee members, for allowing me to speak today. I'm a loving wife, proud mother, and co-owner of a restaurant and food truck business. I am also impacted member of the community, and I'm here today to share my story and express my support for House File 833. My husband arrived in the U.S. in 1994 at the age of 12 under the U.S. Vietnamese Humanitarian Resettlement Program. His grandfather and father were enrolled in the program for fighting alongside the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. They were both imprisoned in a re-education center before coming to the U.S. This trauma caused my husband's father to suffer mentally, which eventually led to his parents' divorce. As a result, my husband spent most of his childhood raised by a single parent. In the year 2000, at the age of 18, my husband made a mistake and received a drug charge. He went to court, agreed to do a short time in boot camp, then had plans for college. But everything changed after court. Suddenly, boot camp was not an option, and he was sent to prison for 16 months. Then, shockingly, he was served immigration papers. Every day we live with the fear that my husband could be deported to Vietnam at any time. It has been 21 years since that incident. My husband has been an upstanding individual since. He has completely changed his life around. He graduated from the University of Minnesota and now works in the health field. He is a loving husband, father to our two sons who are 15 and 7 years old, and an incredible son to his mother. My husband is also a cancer survivor, and in his free time, volunteers and advocates for colon cancer awareness and healthy habits. He also volunteers for our church and at the kids' school. He is a wonderful person who supported me in becoming a business owner. Committee members, I'm asking you to consider giving people like my husband a second chance so that our family can stay together and continue to make positive impact in our community. Please do not judge him for the mistakes he made years ago as a very young adult. See them as the person they are now, as parents and law-abiding citizens contributing to the community. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and committee members for allowing me to share my story.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Mr. Vang, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. My name is Damu Vang, and I would just like to say thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my story and to show my support for House Law 833. I am 19 years old, and I live in the city of St. Paul. I'm the oldest of four children, and I'm also an Impact community member as well. I'm at this phase where I'm supposed to focus on my life and focus on college, but about a year ago, I overheard my parents speaking about deportation, and I had learned that my dad has a removal order to Laos. I thought I misunderstood the conversation at first, so I went to my parents to clarify exactly what I heard, and to my surprise, everything that they were speaking about, it was all true, and I'm still in shock today as I can't even imagine a world without my dad being at home. He has always given me these little life lectures about making good choices, learning from his mistakes, and how important it was for me to succeed. I thought it was those usual parent lectures that they always give at first, but with everything that's happening, I'm starting to realize the true meaning behind it all. My dad made a mistake when he was in 1996, when he was 18 years old, just a year younger than I am today, and he has never gotten into any trouble since. He came to the U.S. in 1978 with his family, including my grandfather, who was a young Hmong soldier who fought in a secret war led by General Vang Pao, and he fought on behalf of the Americans. Minnesota has been my father's home for nearly 40 years now, and he and my mom have been together for 26 years. He has raised me, my three siblings, and he even takes care of my grandparents. About a few months ago, my mother had a stroke, and we have been struggling as she gradually begins to recover. It's devastating to think that things could get any worse with the lingering thought of deportation, you know, is always in our mind. My dad, he's the foundation of our family, and without him, I know that we will fall apart. He is what holds us together. And I just like to say, please support House File 833 and consider giving people like my father another chance. Thank you all for listening to me speak.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Catherine Middlebrook. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Catherine Middlebrook, Chief Appellate Public Defender. My office provides representation statewide to indigent criminal defendants for appeals and post-convictions of their criminal cases. Oftentimes we end up with a post-conviction, which is an alternative to a direct appeal because that direct appeal time, 30 or 90 days, has passed. The post-conviction statute, as you've heard, has a 2-year time bar unless one of the exceptions apply. As we all know, and you've heard, a criminal conviction can have severe immigration consequences that are often even worse than the criminal sentence. And oftentimes these don't arise until many years beyond the 2-year time limit. As we've just heard from impacted family members, the removal can sometimes be many, many years from when the actual criminal conviction was entered. In my office, we see these immigrant cases with unlawful convictions, but we're prevented from getting the case back into court to challenge either an invalid or an unconstitutional conviction because of the two-year time bar. None of the other exceptions in the post-conviction statute apply in these situations. That's why this bill, the PCR bill, and this exception for immigration is necessary. The goal of this exception is to allow someone with immigration consequences because of a criminal conviction that are triggered by any one of the three stages listed in that exception to get back into court to challenge the unlawful conviction outside of the two-year time bar. This exception provides an avenue to get into court. It does not invalidate any of the convictions. It just allows that ability to get into court, and the petitioner obviously has to prove up the merits of the case in order to get relief. So that, you know, obviously there's, you know, many of these cases that we just can't do anything about at this point, and we're supporting this bill so that we can get into court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Middlebrook. Last on the list, I have Jorge Saavedra. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Jorge Saavedra. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. John Choi, the county attorney, was unable to be here today. I'm appearing in his stead. Madam Chair, Representative Herr, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office now for 2 years has had a collateral consequences policy where we've been examining collateral consequences, including immigration consequences, on a variety of different cases. And the situations that you've heard about today really illustrate the long arm of collateral consequences that sometimes settle in decades later. And consequences that were never intended at the time that we prosecuted those cases. This provision, Your Honor, gives an individual the opportunity to access the justice system and to have a judge take a look at these adjudications from long ago. And we believe that that is just and equitable. This provision, Your Honor, also becomes a tool for prosecutors to reexamine these cases. And we believe that we have an important role to play here, and we welcome the opportunity to do that on these cases where we can examine what is a just and equitable result for these cases. You know, our experience really shows us that there is an important justice and community interest in resolving these cases, and we'd like the opportunity to do that. This legislation does that, and we urge your support of this legislation.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add real quick before we get into questions that I wanted to be really clear. For example, in the case of Min Lam and her husband, that it's not just that somebody, you know, had a criminal record. It's that the advice that they got from their lawyer oftentimes is the issue, that the lawyer was not aware that asking, that telling somebody to take a plea over a really minor charge would lead, would impact their immigration status. And so I just want to be really clear that it's not just people not really, you know, doing what they should be doing. It's that they relied on the legal system to give them the advice they needed to make good decisions for themselves, and that that was lacking. And hence, this PCR bill addresses those pieces of it. So it's not for everybody in this situation, but it is for specific people who fall into similar categories. So with, I just wanted to clarify that before we move into questions.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Herr. I think that's an important point to make. We do have a lot of people on the list to questions and discussion. First, I have Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As an immigration attorney, I just wanted to add my two cents, two points that I'd like to make. First is that oftentimes the immigration consequences of a criminal conviction are disproportionate to that offense. So for example, I've worked with two young men who had really stupid marijuana selling charges when they were in college, and they got deported. And it was just the kind of thing that they shouldn't have been doing. It was really stupid, but they were young and they were permanent residents who had basically lived in the United States their whole lives. And both of those people I've stayed in touch with over the years, and they've grown up to have families and careers and really lived fine, upstanding lives. And so oftentimes people who have minor convictions, especially when they have to do with controlled substances, will get removed for something that they could have paid fines, served their sentence, and moved on and had a good life, a law-abiding life. And so that was one point that I wanted to make. The second is just that, as a lot of the testifiers have described, the immigration laws around convictions are very, very confusing, even to skilled attorneys. The definition of conviction is just totally different in immigration law. And so oftentimes it's very unintuitive. And so someone might accept a plea deal, as our last testifier described, and it would have been better for them to actually plead guilty and like serve prison time and often, you know, take a harsher conviction to avoid being removable. And so oftentimes people are not getting that advice, and it's very much not intuitive. And so if they don't have counsel, then they're even more lost. And so those are the two points I just wanted to make. I think this bill is really important and really good. And it's not letting people off the hook. It's just giving them an opportunity to really rectify this injustice in their conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Next on the list is Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hurd, for bringing this bill forward. You know, just listening to the testifiers and so on, Mr. Vang, keep following the advice of your father. That sounds like very sound counsel from a very wise man. I'm listening to this, and I was going to ask for Representative Feist's advice on this, or to wait to hear from her, because she does work in this field. And it sounds like some people are just to clear the air a little bit, that this breakdown is happening at the attorney and judge level, and the marching orders that the ICE agents or law enforcement get are coming down from that branch, are coming down from judges, are coming down from because of these convictions. So, I would hope that there is some grace for these individuals that have to do their jobs when they're called out to go and bring people in. With that being said, are the attorneys and the judges, are they receiving better training on how to approach these types of situations so that we don't have a continuation of people receiving bad counsel and receiving convictions that will end up having these immigrants run into these deportation issues? Representative Hur, can you have that?
Representative Hur.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Grossel. We do have Linus Chan, a U of M law professor and attorney here, and he can address that question for you. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chan, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Linus Chan. I teach at the University of Minnesota Law School. I run a clinic that represents people who are detained, and I've been working with Cal, Release Minnesota 8, and other members of the community organizations that you just heard from on this bill. To answer your question, Representative Grossel, I will say that yes, since 2010, after the Supreme Court issued a decision called Padilla versus Kentucky, criminal defense lawyers have been and continue to work on different methodologies to make sure that mistakes such as not giving proper advice or giving incorrect advice are no longer going to be recognized and part of the system now. One of the things about this particular bill is that because the situation happened many years before 2010, there was an old rule understanding that immigration consequences were considered collateral consequences and was not the job of a defense attorney. And of course, so those old convictions are primarily what we are actually targeting with this particular bill. And the hope, of course, is that as we go forward and as systems get get more entrenched and better placed, and there are more resources, and every single criminal defense attorney now, from here on now, know for a fact that it is part of their job is to make sure to properly inform them, then yeah, we're hopeful that, that later convictions will not have these sort of defects. I hope that answers your
question. Follow up. Yep. Thank you, Professor Chan. Follow up, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chan. You know, that does help, you know, to make sure that there's going to be an end to this line of people who have been misrepresented or received bad counsel, you know, so that they can continue with their process of becoming U.S. citizens. You know, if somebody is here going through the process, by golly, you know, give them every opportunity to make sure that they can finish that process and give them the best counsel possible. I guess with this bill, Representative Herr, does this bill specifically covers legal immigrants, correct?
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Grossel. Yes, that those with status that I don't know the correct word, but yes, they are here legally and came to the United States under specific agreements. Yes.
And, Mr. Chan has his hand up. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt Representative Herr. My apologies.
That's okay, because I was going to defer to Mr. Chan as well, just to make sure that he can explain the status of those who are here.
Just
okay, Mr. Chan, and then we'll move on to the next question. Yep, go ahead.
Just to clarify, the bill doesn't specifically delineate people with or without status. However, it specifically only really will help people who are deportable because of a criminal conviction. If you are here without status, you're going to be deportable regardless of whether you have a criminal conviction or not. So this bill really, it doesn't discriminate between people with status or without status, but if you are removable or deportable by virtue of not having status, then this bill probably will not reach to help you in your particular situation, because it won't prevent deportation based on the fact that you are not, that you don't have status in the United States. So it's only the people with status that usually can be deported solely because of a criminal conviction. I hope that.
Right. Yep. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chan. I think that was Representative Grossel. We've got 5 or 6 other people on the list. So
just a few words.
Real quick, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Herr, if you would be so kind as to look at that language and make that portion of it clear. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr.
Yeah, thank you. Moving on to Vice Chair Mohler, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to thank Representative Herr for bringing this bill and for all the advocates for your hard work on it. I really like this language now, and you've very narrowly tailored it. And I appreciate all the hard work that's gone into this. I also just wanted to point out and really highlight what Ms. Biddlebrook said. As someone who is an appellate lawyer, I know the post-conviction laws very well, and this just really does get someone's foot in the door. They still have a burden of proving what they need to prove in order to get relief. And so I just wanted to make that point that it just gives people the opportunity, which really is a matter of fairness, because if you think about the fact that immigration laws are changing all the time and are often retroactive, but yet people are bound by the 2-year rule here, they don't have an opportunity to really address those issues. I do have a quick question for Ms. Middlebrook. And that question is, I'm wondering about when the 2-year clock starts to run for past cases. Would it be when if this bill is signed into law, then people in the past have 2 years? If you could just address that would be helpful. Thank you.
Ms. Middlebrook.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Mohler. What, based on the language of the exception, what it would be, the 2 years would start to run at any of those 3 stages of the immigration process. So it would be, because obviously it would be when the claim arises. And what you've heard here is there's many There's many of these cases that are, you know, really quite old, and there was no immigration consequence at that point. But now, more recently, there's been a notice to appear to be removed. And so that would be like the later of those three things that are listed in that exception. And it would be the 2 years from that it would start to run. So it would allow of any of those three stages of the immigration process would trigger that 2 year. And obviously the latter one would be the focus, because that would be the point where someone would be getting the notice that they're being removed.
Representative Mueller. All right, I'm gonna assume that answered your question, Vice Chair Mueller. Moving on to Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members. Representative Herr, I like the idea of your bill. But I think it's right now there's a hole so big in it that you can drive a tank through it. This was the specifically designed originally for those who came over, for the members and their families who fought with the United States Army and the United States military during the Vietnam War. Unfortunately, public defenders didn't do what they were supposed to do, and not just public defenders, attorneys and defense attorneys, giving the proper information they should have. And this issue was dealt with in that court case back in 2010. So since that time, this should not be an issue anymore. There's a couple things I'd like to see in this bill. One would be getting it narrowed down to those dates from when they came over to that court ruling to limit some of this, because I think this can be abused too easily otherwise. And also to make sure that it deals with those here in legal status. If they're not here legally and they commit a crime, they're deported. But a lot of them who are here illegally, unless they commit a crime, they won't be deported. They get to stay here. And with the current administration opening up the wall, we have the caravans coming from South America up to our southern border again. But so I would like to get this more defined. Then I also have concerns about the Ramsey County dealing with this. They have their consequential or collateral consequences policy. Now, if you're here illegally or you're here as an immigrant, you get special status, whether you're going to be convicted of crime or reference an actual legal citizen, because that status of you could get imported makes a decision on whether or not to charge a person or not. Frustrating to me, as all of us are equal under the law and we have to follow, well, everybody has to follow all the laws. Unfortunately, there's personal responsibility when you break the law. I want those families to stay here as well, because they are given bad information on the possibility of a plea deal that they took, and there's some consequences that they weren't made aware of. So I'd like to narrow this down and make sure that it deals with those people who, especially for those whose families helped our military during the Vietnam War. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Moving on to Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had just a clarification question and then a process question. And maybe I don't even know if Representative Mueller works on this or Representative Feist or one of the other testifiers. My first question is, I just wanted to clarify that the bill language only applies to people that got bad advice way back when. Is that accurate? I guess that would be to the bill's author.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, Representative, Scott, sorry. Professor Chan can answer that question.
Professor Chan.
Yes. The language now, just I want to make sure, and this is a confusing point. The bill language only applies to people who were not properly advised of their immigration consequences. That is what triggers the exception. It does not mean, though, that it's a substantive basis for why the conviction is not good. Just as an example, if someone is filing a post-conviction for a conviction prior to 2010, they had insufficient or did not get good advice, they can file the petition, but they would now need to prove another example or another reason why that conviction was improperly obtained. Just because Padilla itself, the 2010 decision, is not retroactive. So I just want to clarify that because that language can be a little bit confusing, but you know, it is not a substantive change to the underlying law. This is only a procedural way to get your foot in the door, and that is if you didn't properly get advice, being that the idea being that if you did properly get advice, then you could have or understood what you might have been getting into when you got convicted. I hope that clarified.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you for that answer. And that leads me to the next question, and that is, what documentation is necessary to prove that you got bad advice? How are these, you know, how do you provide evidence that you got bad advice? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Professor Chan, and then we'll move on to Representative Novotny.
Actually, I think I might defer a little bit to Ms. Middlebrook because she sees a lot more of these cases. I have some ideas, but I think Ms. Middlebrook could probably answer a little bit more clearly what are some ways that you could show a lack of advice or ineffective assistance.
Ms. Middlebrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, most of the time on these cases, we have the transcripts from the plea hearing and sentencing. So we can see what was said in court and if there was anything said about the immigration consequences. Often the written plea petition as well may include language or may not. We obviously have the information from our clients as to what their expectations were, what they were told. As we go past Padilla, there's more and more, the language is much more directive in the written plea petitions, as well as what the attorneys have to advise a defendant about immigration consequences. So those would be and the record, what we would look at to see what the advice was.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Middlebrook. And I'll remind members, too, that we're laying this over. So if you have more in-depth questions, there is time to discuss those with Representative Herr. Next, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And the question is for Representative Herr. The basic thing that this all comes down to is the concept of America is second chances and making sure people, you know, can come to this country and become part of society and grow. And that's why I'm in favor of the bill. Somebody did something 30 years ago and they have been law abiding and contributing to the community ever since then. I'm all for it. My question for the author is, if this is going to be laid over, is there anyone that is in jeopardy between now and then? Why are we laying it over? Is there someone that could possibly be deported by delaying this action? And, you know, what's the reason for laying it over as opposed to moving it forward as fast as we can? Thank you.
Representative Novotny, I think that's more of a question for me. And so just to clarify, too, because I know we have a lot of new members on this committee, we're laying it over. We're not laying it on the table. So laying it over means that I can choose to include it in our Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill and that it can move forward this year as a part of an omnibus bill. It's more of a time management and strategy decision on the best way to make sure we can move this forward this year. Any follow-up, Representative Devani? Oh, yes, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair, Chair Rickerfin. And I just wanted to answer really quick Representative Otney's question about are there people? Yes, there are people who are in jeopardy of being deported right now. I was just informed that there is currently a plane load of Vietnamese individuals who are actually going to be deported this week, and that there have been people who have been deported in the time frame that we have not done anything about this issue as well.
Thank you, Representative Hur. And I'll note as well that there is a fiscal cost to this this bill as well, which is why we need to keep it as part of our omnibus finance bill. Any follow-up, Representative Otney? Otherwise, we need to move forward.
I think you just answered it. Thank you.
All right. Last, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hur, thank you for bringing this bill. I just want to speak. Representative Vice addressed a lot of the things, some of the things that I was going to say in great detail from her perspective as an immigration attorney. I was a public defender before the Padilla case came down, and I recall the fear and anxiety that I had as a public defender when I had clients that I knew could have some possible immigration consequences for accepting a plea deal. And I do recall there were attorneys that knew that because of the way things were set up, they didn't really have to be concerned about that. I would always try to reach out to immigration attorneys before I had them take any type of plea deal to try to deal with that. But I know that that wasn't always and it wasn't often the case. So I'm glad to see this bill coming forward, and I'm hoping we move it forward because there is no reason why, as Representative Novotny said, in a place that is geared around and the mission is second chances, that they shouldn't have the ability to get their day in court to relieve themselves of the anxiety of whether or not they're going to be deported. We should make sure we're doing things to make sure families are not separated, that our community members that are law-abiding, tax-paying, and really influential and positive in our community can stay in the community. So thank you for bringing this bill. I will vote for it and push for it. Thank you for bringing it. I think it is much needed. I'm looking forward to providing some peace of mind for those individuals that have not had it for all these years. So thank you for bringing it.
Thank you, Representative Frazier, and thank you to all of our testifiers and the good discussion this morning. I will also put a pin in remembering that this may be another good reason to fund public defenders so that they can make sure they have the time and ability to give good advice to their clients. And with that, I will lay over House File 833 for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, members. That, we'll move to the Representative Hur.
Sorry, Manager. I just wanted to say something really quick before we do these. I know that we're short on time, but I just wanted to address Representative Johnson's question about how this bill, the hole is so big that, you know, and there really isn't a need since he referenced the 2010. I just want to be really clear that there is a huge need, and this language is very narrow already. And the fact that for us to point out that people should be law-abiding citizens, they are law-abiding citizens who made a mistake. This is a matter of circumstances, that when American citizens who are under the same circumstances, right, just by the matter of circumstances, they were born here versus another country. They've done nothing to fight for this country. They've done nothing to contribute to this country in the way some of these immigrants have. And because of a mistake that they made, which American children make those same mistakes every day, and they do not live the same consequences. And when somebody pays their debt, we should not punish them a second time. And so for us to say that people are not law-abiding citizens and they shouldn't have made this mistake, it's a mistake made by everybody every day because of young brains are not developed at that age to be able to make good decisions, and these are small infractions. This is not because somebody murdered someone or this is an issue of, you know, some heinous crime. This is really small types of crimes that people are getting, you know, taking plea bargains for. So I just want to be really clear on that. And before we lay this out, I just want to say thank you to all the advocates who brought their stories to the table. In our community, you don't share this type of things with people because there's a great deal of shame with it. And it's because people were willing to tell their stories. Advocates were willing to tell their stories. The organizations came together that we were able to compromise on this really narrow language that to most advocates, this is not expansive enough to really address the situation. And so I just want to say thank you. And my apologies for going along, but I wanted to make sure that that was said.
Yep, and we've got two other bills on the agenda, but thank you, Representative Hur. It is already laid over because I said that it was already laid over. Thank you to our testifiers. We'll move on to House File 717. It's a Representative Vang bill. Representative Vang, would you like to move your bill?
So move, Madam Chair. Thank you.
House File Representative Vang moves that House File 717 be recommended for to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. Sorry, got to get the magic words on the record, Representative Vang. Go ahead.
Thank you for that. So House File 717 does two simple things. It repeals the statute of limitations for alleged sex abuse cases and alleged wrongful death cases by a peace officer and gives a five-year retroactive window. This bill was part of the police reform package that got left out when it passed last summer, and the language was worked on to be more concise and specific to types of claims that can be brought forth. And more importantly, this bill is a bill about healing and allows a pathway for justice for the families. It is an important tool for families to bring forth claims and hold our police officers, who are supposed to be institutional guardians of our lives, accountable. We cannot reach another point, another boiling point like we did last summer. When one of our public servants breaks the trust of protecting the people, it is our job, at the minimum, to not block their path towards justice, or the family's path towards justice. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have testifiers here today to speak in support of this bill.
All right. Thank you. First on the list, I have Ms. Garraway. Ms. Garraway, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi. Yes. My name is Tashira Garraway. I am the fiance and also the mother of Justin Tigan's 14-year-old son, Justin Tigan Jr. I am also the founder of an organization called Family Supporting Families Against Police Violence, and I work with about 25 families that have lost their loved ones here in the state of Minnesota at the hands of law enforcement. That includes Valerie Castile, as well as Jamar Clark's family and George Floyd's fiance as well. Would you like me to continue?
Yep, go ahead, Ms. Garraway, with your testimony.
So the reason that this bill is important to so many of our families is because there is many families that have been basically, I feel in my heart, denied of the process that we all deserve as far as fighting for our loved ones. I will go off of my particular story, short and brief. Justin Tigan, the father of my 14-year-old son, was brutally beat to death by the St. Paul police, and he was thrown inside of a trash dumpster August 19, 2009. My mother, Justin's mother, and I walked into the mortuary, and Justin's skull was cracked in half. He had dog bites on his body. His wrist was detached from his arms. His little brothers and sisters, as well as my son, could barely recognize Justin in the casket. We tried our best while we were grieving. We were in a state of devastation. We were trying to get the information that we needed from the St. Paul Police Department. The information was stalled out. Our family was treated. It was the most inhumane thing I had ever seen. We seen a video of Justin. He did get pulled over by the St. Paul police, which they never told us. They told us that he was in an accident and missing from the scene. We found out later that it was actually a traffic stop. And we just wanted answers of why he ended up beaten all over and dead in a dumpster. At that point, once we reached out to the forensic pathologist, we seen now, the St. Paul police denied us the right to ever view this video. Once we seen the video, we see the police chase Justin, and we see the video go blank. Once it goes blank, it is clear that it was edited. At that point, we reached out to an attorney, and we started seeking more answers, and that's when I began to be followed. Justin's mother began to be followed. What the St. Paul Police Department has done to my family and what the other families around Minnesota that I work with have gone through in the discovery process of trying to just get what we need as any normal human beings would seek answers for their loved ones. We're not doing anything that any other human being would not do. And that process is being stalled out. We are being followed and harassed. We are being intimidated while we are trying to seek the answers that we deserve for our loved ones. In addition to that, we must consider again that the families are grieving. The families are hurting in this 3-year time that we have in the present. So while you are grieving, while your family is fighting for justice and the cases are being held open, while intimidation is happening, the time is ticking. So many families have not been allowed to get the justice that they deserve based on these things, based on the fact that time runs out. And a lot of families, when this happened to our family, we were in a state of devastation. We didn't even know how all of this worked. All we knew it was Justin was dead. All we knew was that he got pulled over and he was dead. That's all that we knew. So I am speaking on behalf of the rest of the families within my organization, and I am speaking for my own family. There should be no time limit. If a family can bring forth substantial evidence to prove that their loved one was murdered unjustly, we should be able to have our day in court, because the court still has to decide whatever happens. But we're not even able to get that day. Prior to George Floyd, prior to all the riots, prior to the buildings burning on fire, our families was in the Capitol pleading for this particular bill to get passed. There is too many grievances in the community to just move forward. You have to help the families that are already out here suffering. There's over 429 murders at the hands of law enforcement in the last 20 years. Over. If you multiply 429 times co-workers, brothers and sisters, significant others, children, mothers, classmates, that's over 1 million people in the state of Minnesota alone. With just the 429, and there is only one family out of all of those families that have ever been granted true justice. And that is the minority man that killed the white woman, Justine Damon. There is no way that out of all of these bodies that was the only officer that was guilty. And there is no way that the state of Minnesota should show our families and our community that is the only family that deserves justice. I understand that there is families and people that officers protect in certain areas and certain statuses and certain racial backgrounds. But there is a certain group of people that are not being protected and that are being brutalized. And those people deserve justice. My family and the rest of these families should not have been shown that Justine Damon's family or her life was the only life that was valued out of all of these lives. We deserve justice, and we deserve just as much as George Floyd's family deserved. We've seen in that video, God opened the doors for the world to see what is happening to our people and around the United States, but in the state of Minnesota alone. So we are pleading, our families are literally begging at this point for justice. And this bill being passed will give our families that justice, or at least our day in court to fairly be able to fight for our loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garraway. I know it can be really hard to speak to that grief and speak about that publicly. So we really appreciate your honesty and being willing to testify today. We will move on to the next testifier, Jonathan McClellan. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, my name is Jonathan McClellan. I'm with Minnesota Justice Coalition. I would like to thank this committee for giving me an opportunity to share with you today. I would like to thank Representative Vang for carrying this important piece of legislation that will provide access to justice for many families around our state. One of the common threads that you hear through the stories from the families who lost a loved one to a police shooting or other violent means is that they don't care about material gain. They care about getting answers. Why did my son, daughter, brother, sister, mother, father, husband, wife lose their life? Some families have waited years for these answers, and they are still waiting. Persons who have been sexually abused should also have a way to seek redress. It should not matter what title you hold, because we are all taught that nobody is above the law. We in the legal profession know that the most powerful tool we have in our toolkit is the discovery process. Lawyers are required to conduct an investigation to determine whether a case is justiciable or has merit. Currently, the statute of limitations is 3 years, and during that 3 years, the police control the evidence, everything from the video to statements from witnesses, which obstructs families and legal professionals from doing the required investigation before filing a case in court. Furthermore, with a family that is dealing with the grief and loss, having to figure out and plan for a funeral, care for siblings and children, oftentimes leaves the family fighting an uphill battle with one hand tied behind their back. This process should be available to ensure justice for families who have lost a loved one, to ensure our system is just, accountable, and transparent. The death of a parent or other close relative from any cause has a special impact on children. As with all untimely deaths, children must cope with the loss of a parent and the disruptions in family routines, living standards, and family roles. At too early an age, children are faced with the reality of life's fragility and the fact that bad things can happen unexpectedly at any time. However, family members who lost a loved one killed by law enforcement must undergo further trauma by not knowing, not being able to have their questions answered, and this destroys these families. I have personally witnessed the consumption and pain this has on families going through this struggle, and the fight never ends. While the families are left picking up the pieces and trying to glue these very pieces of their lives together, the slightest trauma related to the death of their loved one tears it all down. Traumas like the murder of Philando Castile, the murder of Lionel Lewis, Demetrius Hill, Kobe Heisler, Jafford Smith, Hardell Sherrill, Marcus Golden, Jamar Clark, Travis Jordan, Billy Hughes, Isaac Aiden, Brian Quinones, Justin Tigan, George Floyd, and many others. We need accountability. We need transparency. We need a lawful mechanism for these families to seek justice in the courts in whatever form it may come. The passing of this bill will provide a way for the questions to be answered. As a democratic society, we owe that to these families. In 1964, Martin Luther King spoke at Oberlin College in Ohio after three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. King said, "The time is always right to do what's right." Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. We have one more testifier on the list today, Bill Hutton. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair. After about a year, you think I'd get that mute thing figured out, but it's difficult. My name is Bill Hutton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'm also here representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police and the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I really didn't expect to testify today as we submitted a letter. Our position is stated, I think, very clearly within that letter that the statute of limitations is designed to promote justice by encouraging plaintiffs to diligently pursue their claims. Timeliness is important. This is based on evidence could be lost, memories could fade, and witnesses may disappear. Needless to say, we do not support the way that the bill is written, and so we will let our letter stand as it is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hutton. And members, it should be in the packet of information as well as posted with the posting for this meeting. That is the end of the list of testifiers. Are there any member questions regarding this bill? Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members. I do have some questions on this bill, but I'm not going to get into them to now. I'm just going to make a clarification on Mr. McLennan's testimony. The United States is not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic. A democracy is basically majority rules. We are a country of laws that our people are bound by the Constitution.
Representative Johnson, rules. If you could stick to the bill, that would be great.
That's what I'm getting to. And we've gotten to the point now we're calling our country what it is not. I think people need to understand that. And so, but getting back to the bill, I'm just wondering if the author can tell me why they're just picking on law enforcement. I know we have teachers that are in the same situation where they've sexually assaulted and did other things, and sometimes they're not excluded in this. And I wonder also why they open up completely instead of just extend the statute of limitation instead of 6, maybe going to 10. So I'm just wondering why you're picking on law enforcement, because they are out there trying to do their best. Law enforcement does their bad. Law enforcement does not want any bad officers out there, and they do their best to get rid of them.
All right, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for your question. I just want to be clear, this is not picking on law enforcement. This is not singling them out. This was brought forth even before the George Floyd incident by families. This bill was inspired by families like Tashira, who've experienced injustice to her fiance. And so this bill is very important, and now with and it will continue to happen, and families will continue to receive injustice and no accountability, and police officers will receive no accountability. And so this is a tool to add into the box to make sure that our institutions are held accountable. So this is nothing new. This is not to single out law enforcement. This is happening for many years. Many families do not get their day in court. And when the boiling point reached with the murder of George Floyd, this bill was added into the police reform package, and unfortunately got left out when it passed because there were some concerns about the open-endedness of what types of claims can be brought forth. And so we continue to work with stakeholders to close up that language a little bit and be more concise and specific. And this is the language that we came about.
All right, thank you, Representative Vang. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one thing I've been struggling with a lot here recently is I hear our members who are lawyers using the words killing, murder, all of these things, these words, in spite of the fact that there has been no trial, there has been no conviction. Our public safety commissioner sent out an email to all the legislators in reference to words matter. Words matter. And to be careful how we use our words to make sure that we paint an accurate picture for our citizens. Now, I took that to heart. And I know, Madam Chair, that if you're representing someone, or however it goes, and someone uses terminology that is not correct yet, you're going to be on them. And I can see that. I know that about you. You'd be on them. So I would like our members, please, until you know all of the facts, until the conviction is there, refer to it as we should, as this is an ongoing case. Now, with that being said, I do want to ask, a wrongful death or a deliberate homicide or a sexual assault, don't we already have law in place that would hold individuals accountable for intentional murder of someone or a sexual assault? Representative Vang, please.
Representative Vang.
This bill addresses more on the civil side. I am assuming you mean like the criminal investigations and whatnot. I can defer that to House staff to look up, you know, the statutes that deals with that. But this bill specifically deals with civil suits.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Yep, Representative Grossel.
And with that being said, you know, having been through a shooting in my law enforcement career, where I was shot by the suspect, and he ultimately resulted in that gentleman's death. A horrible, horrible situation to be in for everybody. And the last thing any officer wants to do is to have someone die in the process of their duties, during their duties. Never had any officer that I've ever known strapped on their duty belt, put on their badge, and went out looking to intentionally hurt somebody. And I have been in some very ugly, ugly situations to where I had to make that decision. I had to make the decision whether to take an individual's life or not. That is a very horrible place to be. But we are required to make those decisions, and only in a split second. So I can tell you that I went through the civil process. They had their opportunity to make sure that things were done right and that they received justice. Even in that, even in my own experience, the family deserves justice and to follow the law and to have a recourse if they feel that an injustice was done. But if we're Representative Vang, if you would be so kind as to look into that for me, please, and see, do we already have laws in place, even in the civil side, for that statute of limitations, as far as making sure that families receive justice in the case of a wrongful or a deliberate death? And I believe it is in place. But if you would confirm that for me, I would greatly appreciate it.
Representative Grossel, we can have House Research can answer that question, but I would assume if there was a mechanism for families like those referenced that they would already be doing that. And to highlight what Representative Vang said, you know, this is a civil law issue. So it isn't a beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not a criminal process. This is the statute of limitations strictly related to civil cases. With that, we'll move on to Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Vang for bringing this bill forward and to Shira, Mr. Shira, who came to share her story. I want to just remind us that this bill, right, is really dealing with eliminating the statute of limitations for to file a wrongful death lawsuit. And I think to the question of why aren't teachers included in this, I mean, maybe that has happened, but it's very rare to see a situation where a teacher would be responsible for the death of a child. I'm not saying that would never happen, but where we see this happening is in our in situations that were brought forward today. I just wanted to point out that in 2013, the legislature passed the Child Victims Act, which lifted the statute of limitations, giving past victims of child abuse 3 years to sue their abusers and the organizations that employed them or directed their voluntary activities. And so that this isn't unprecedented. To ask for this type of thing for these situations is not unprecedented. So I just wanted to thank Representative Vang for bringing that forward.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple of questions. I'm just wondering why the, you know, 4 year, 6 year, whatever it is right now, why that's not enough time to bring these cases, especially, you know, with the heightened awareness of when these incidences happen. Certainly people I would think within that period of time that's a current law would be able to bring a lawsuit. So if Representative Vang can answer that question, then I would, Madam Chair, like to hear the answer to the question by House Research that was previously brought up via Representative Grossel. Thank you.
So first I'll go to a response from Representative Herr, and then I'm not sure who on House Research wants to take that, but Representative Vang, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for your question. You know, as you can see from the testimonies of Tashira Garraway, that the families go through a lot of processing the grief, the trauma, the change in their life when it comes to learning of the death of their loved ones. It's a learning process. It's a learning curve for them to learn about the system that's going on, and even to find an attorney to gather up the financial resources to be ready to file for a claim. And so it takes time, it takes a lot of emotional labor, a lot of financial resources. And I think that my testimony, Tashira, can speak more elaborately to why that limitation, when the time is ticking, it's not enough for them to get ready for their day in court.
Ms. Garraway, if you want to respond to that, but I'll just remind everybody we've got one more bill on the agenda today, so if we could try to keep your answer as short as you can. Thank you, Ms. Garraway.
Thank you. Representative Peggy, as I stated before, families are grieving out of this world when this happens to our loved ones. In addition to grieving, I can only speak from my experience, but I'm speaking on behalf of other families as well today. And during the time that our families are grieving, we are having our cases literally stalled out. I'm telling you from my heart what I experienced. We literally illegally watched the police hold on to information that they were supposed to be releasing to the family. I have families right now that are not getting the information over a year they have been requesting to receive. They are not getting the information that they rightfully deserve. So these cases are being stalled out while they are trying to find an attorney. These cases are not easy to find an attorney to take the cases. In addition to that, I'm giving you my lived experience that I was afraid. I am in fear of my life right now today because I have been followed. They have sat outside my home with putting my child in the car. I don't hate police. I'm not picking on police. I'm telling you my lived experience. I have police officers that are my friends, that are good people that are out there. But we must understand that there is people that are out there that are not doing the right thing. And the family should have a right without this time limit, as they are hurting, to bring forth their case if they can bring substantial evidence. If you want the community to heal, if you want the riots to stop, if you want, you can't say I'm sorry for what happened to you and not show anything to prove that you're sorry for what happened to the rest of these families, including George Floyd. Again, there was only one family that got true justice in history of Minnesota. And that is a white woman that was killed by a minority man. Let's face it for what it is and heal the community. And the way that you heal the community is allowing the families to get their day in court. And the way that you do that is by removing the statute of limitation, giving 5 years for any of the families to bring forth their cases. And then the community can heal and move forward together in unity. That's what it's about. It's not about separation of the police, picking on the police, any of that. I love police officers that are doing the right thing. And that's all.
Thank you very much, Ms. Garraway. Mr. Johnson from House Research, if you have an answer to the question from Representative Scott and Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, members, my understanding of the question relates to what the statutory statute of limitations is in wrongful death cases. There are a few different statutes of limitations that apply. In general, the statute of limitations is 3 years after the death of the person, but the case must be brought within 6 years of the time of the act or omission. So if a person is seriously injured, for example, and doesn't die for several years, the limitations would be 6 years from that date of offense. There is no statute of limitations for a death caused by an intentional act that constitutes murder.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And we're going to get to Representative Novotny and Representative Hollins, and then we need to move on to the next bill. So Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. My question is for Testifier Garraway. Out of all the names that were mentioned, of all the cases we're all familiar with, what would this law save? What would this change? Were you able to file a law? I'll wait for a follow-up then. Thank you.
Yep, sorry. Ms. Garraway.
I'm sorry, I didn't really fully understand or even hear the question, but I think I heard into it. What did you say? What will it change out of all of the names that you heard?
Yes. Were any of these cases that you mentioned, were any of them blocked from filing a civil lawsuit?
Yes. Yes, they were. Many families that I work with right now today, they have been, because of the cases being stalled out, the evidence not being given to the families, my family as well, we were not able to file. That's why we're here today. That's why we are basically pleading for this at this point. We're pleading for justice for our loved ones. We're pleading for something that we should be given by other human beings. We're pleading for it. And so that is why we are here, because myself and the rest of families, Fernando Castillo's mother was able to, because she, the video went viral for everyone to see, just like George Floyd. But there's hundreds of more families out here that their video did not go viral, or their video was edited. They got to the evidence before we could get to the evidence, our loved ones. And so therefore, it was swept under the rug. Our cases were swept under the rug. There was different stories gave out to the community and the media. So therefore, so many other families are just did not get justice, or did not get their fair day in court or their fair process because of this limitation on the time limit. So therefore, that is why, again, we are sitting here pleading for that.
Representative Botany, quick follow-up. Yep, so quick follow-up.
Did you at any point have civil representation? At what point did that attach?
Ms. Garraway, if you want to answer that.
Yes, we did. This is why this bill is so important to me, because probably close to two-year range, when it was approaching the 3 years, is when we were able to get legal representation. At that time, the statute of limitation ran out. The attorney sent us a letter saying that he was giving up the case because we had ran out of time. And it was devastating because our family was already mourning. And while we were trying to mourn, we were being followed because we were trying to get answers. We were seeking legal consultation with so many things. If you guys only knew the inhumane things that are happening to my family and the rest of these families. I was just followed recently. I was just followed by an undercover car. This is real and this is going on. And I want to say, because it has not happened to you or someone you love, does not mean that it's not happening. This is real. The people have overstepped their authority. And yes, we did end up at some point getting legal representation, but these cases are not easy to be picked up by attorneys. And they're holding open the cases. It's just so many things going on. And I wish you guys could really find it in your heart to understand what I'm fighting for today.
Thank you, Ms. Garraway. We will go to Representative Hollins, and then we'll lay the bill over. So Representative Hollins, if you could stay focused, please.
I will be super brief. Thank you to the testifiers. Thank you to Representative Vang. One thing I want to point out in this really emotional conversation is a very practical point. Lawyers for wrongful death civil suits are often contingency-based, which means they get paid based on how much you end up getting in the end. So a lot of lawyers that take civil suits like this want to see the evidence that's presented in a criminal case before they're willing to take a case on like this. And that's especially important for communities like, Black, Brown, Indigenous, in folks who don't have the money to pay up front for a civil lawsuit. They are relying on lawyers who do contingency fee work. And so for that reason, having an extension of the statute of limitations really makes a lot of sense because they're able to have all that information, see how the criminal case plays out before they decide whether or not they want to take on that civil suit. And so really this is adding to the access of justice. So thank you. That was more of a comment than a question.
Great. Thank you, Representative Holland. And with that, I will lay over House File 717 for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much, Ms. Garraway. I know it's really difficult to give that kind of testimony, and we appreciate you sharing your story with the committee today. So thank you.
We're moving on to the next bill.
Representative Grossel, we're moving on to the next bill. Representative Grossel.
Okay.
If you have additional questions, you can connect with Representative Vang, but we've got to move on to the next bill.
We're just laying these over, Madam Chair.
We're done with this bill. Okay. We need to move on. And with that, we'll move on to House File 992, Representative Long, regarding jail host witnesses. We will be moving. Representative Long, would you like to move House File 992 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
All right. Thank you, Representative Long. The bill is before us. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill. And I know as a fellow chair, you recognize the time constraints we're under. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be as brief as I can. So House File 992 deals with trying to improve our process for justice for individuals who are accused of crimes. We know that none of us want to see innocent people punished for crimes they did not commit. And this bill is about improving our system with regard to testimony from jailhouse informants. We know that there can be strong motivations for incarcerated persons to trade information for leniency. Sometimes this information is accurate, but there is reason to believe that it may not always be credible. This can particularly be the case when informants trade for enhanced leniency multiple times. And there have been reports in our state of incentivized witnesses testifying in multiple unrelated cases. Sometimes these informants could be motivated by gang rivalries or reasons other than justice. And this bill would do two main things. It would improve the disclosure of past informant behavior to defense counsel to allow for credibility to be better determined in court. And it would create a database that would track informant behavior to better analyze trends and to allow for prosecutors to help determine the credibility of witnesses before putting someone on the stand. There would also be anonymized data that would be published annually to help with research and looking for trends. There is support for this bill across the ideological spectrum, including from both Americans for Prosperity and the ACLU. And I have one testifier today, Madam Chair, if I could introduce her now.
All right. Thank you, Representative Long. I have Sarah Jones. Ms. Jones, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Long and committee members. I'm Sarah Jones. I'm the executive director of the Great North Innocence Project. Some of you may remember us as the Innocence Project of Minnesota. I'm here to testify about this bill because it's a very important bill for minimizing the possibilities of wrongful convictions. Overall, nationwide, 7% of all exonerations of innocent people who have been wrongly convicted involve jailhouse witnesses. And in cases where DNA was the factor in exoneration, 17% of those cases involved jailhouse witness testimony. So the scenario I'd like to set is a suspect is being held in jail for a very serious crime, such as murder, robbery, kidnapping. They've been claiming their innocence from the start. They are housed in a jail with another person who had no involvement in the crime, and suddenly that jailhouse witness says that the suspect confessed to them. And the jailhouse witness goes to the prosecutor and says, I've got this information that I'm willing to trade for leniency in my case. It's often cases where the police have the least amount of evidence, and this sort of trading for leniency happens without notification to the victim of the jailhouse witness's crimes. You all might remember Mike Hansen, one of our previous clients who was exonerated. Mike was convicted in part because of a jailhouse witness who claimed that he confessed to murdering his daughter. In fact, Mike was exonerated later, primarily having to do with medical testimony, but the jailhouse witness got a very significant deal for his testimony. And we all have been hearing about the Burrell case in the news, and we have other examples of cases where there are multiple jailhouse witnesses in a single case, where a jailhouse witness has testified in multiple cases in the past, receiving leniency for various crimes. We are very concerned about the impact that has on victims of jailhouse witnesses crimes, and also for the innocent people who may be convicted as a result of incentivized testimony. As Representative Long said, we have support from across a spectrum of ideologies, the Minnesota ALU, the Minnesota State Public Defenders, and Americans for Prosperity Minnesota. Nationwide, this kind of legislation has been passed in other states with bipartisan support. It's actually an initiative of the ALEC, the American Legislative, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but in any case, I just want to emphasize that this is something that will help prosecutors by providing additional information as they assess whether or not to use a jailhouse witness's testimony, as well as providing information for the defense that isn't already required by the rules of criminal procedure. I know you're pressed for time, so okay. I can take questions if anybody has any.
Yep, and I will note for members, we did get permission to go a couple minutes past 10 o'clock, so we do have time. Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Just want to point out a couple things that you said. I'm absolutely in favor of this bill, and it's a good case law that needs to be followed, but this isn't a police issue. This is a prosecution and judges and defense attorneys coming to agreements issue. So most of these cases, this is already case procedures, just standardizing that. So I speak in favor of it, but let's keep focused what it is. It's a system revision or clarification. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Otney. Any other member questions? All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, is there a fiscal note to this bill?
Representative Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Scott. I have not seen one come back yet. This was scheduled pretty quickly after it was introduced, but it is being laid over. And so I suspect we'll have time to assess whether there is a fiscal cost.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would House fiscal analysts know the answer to that question?
Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, a fiscal note has been requested and some preliminary costs have come in. It appears that the Attorney General will be seeking some money to have a database that would keep this information, but the fiscal note is not yet finalized.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you.
All right. Any closing comments, Representative Long?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Ms. Jones for her testimony. And I think the, you know, 1 in 5 exonerations for DNA evidence relating to this shows that this really can have a substantial impact for trying to make sure that justice is being served and innocent people aren't being wrongfully convicted. And I agree with Representative Abbey. This is a systems issue. And I think there's just a smart reform to try to help improve our system and get better justice. So thank you for the committee for hearing the bill.
Yep, thank you, Representative Long. And I will note for this bill and all the others, there are some handouts, information that was emailed out to folks. Would encourage you to take a look at that for more information. And with that, there were no amendments filed, so we will lay over House File 992 for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, members, for a lot of good discussion today. Our next hearing will be Thursday, the 25th. The agenda is posted, and I do want to note, if you haven't checked your email yet this morning, we do have added a committee meeting this Friday in order to have enough time to get through all of the bills and still have some time for discussion. So that has also been posted, and just want to remind members to take a look at that. Thanks again for a good meeting, and with that, we are adjourned.